My name is Graeme Willett. I am a member of the committee of the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives, and we wanted to run this session to draw attention to, or provide an example of, the way in which the small community-based archives, who really were mostly who was represented at the first Minneapolis ALMS, how we work, what we do, what are the kind of issues that are confronting us today. There is, in fact, a session tomorrow at 2:30, a round table, where we're getting together a number of smallish archives, again, to kind of free-form discussion. So if you're interested in this kind of topic, do come to that. What we're going to do is I'm going to provide people with a bit of a history of the archives, on the off chance you might not know all about us. But then my colleagues are going to talk about various aspects of what we do, how we do it, why we do it. I think we'll just start. I'll let people introduce themselves as they go. I guess people are interested in how long they've been involved in the archives and so on. So I got involved in the mid-90s. I was doing a PhD on the history of the gay and lesbian movement in Australia. Well, I started to use the collection, realised how important it was, and then kind of felt I ought to contribute rather than just use the collection. Back in those days, the slightest flicker of interest and you would be roped onto the committee. And once you're onto the committee, there is in fact no way off short of leaving the country. So I am still on the committee. I've been variously president and treasurer and some of those positions, although we work fairly kind of collectively. So what I'm going to do is just do a bit of a history to provide background to some of the issues that other people are going to talk about. But we're hoping to leave lots of time at the end for people to both ask questions, make comments and so on. So the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives, reflections on our first and our next 40 years. At one point I wanted to call this Why Do We Bother? But we generally thought that was a bit negative. But underlying it is, why we do bother, the kind of with a positive spin. The archives was established in 1978, so we've just had our 40th anniversary, at the 4th National Homosexual Conference. Back in the 70s, beginning in 1975, there were annual conferences of what were, people still called themselves homosexuals, gays, lesbians, held annually in different cities around Australia, conferences of activists, which lasted until the mid-1980s, when they were basically supplanted by conferences for people who are active around the issues of AIDS, HIV/AIDS. They were held in different city in every year. In 1978, it happened to be held in Sydney. This was in the aftermath of the first Mardi Gras, which you may not know, was intended to be a kind of evening celebration, marching down Oxford Street, which was emerging as the gay capital, the gay precinct in Sydney. For reasons that we still don't really know, the police took exception to this, so they had a permit and everything, launched an attack on the demonstration, and there was strong resistance. So this was in June, which was when we used to celebrate Mardi Gras. In August, the annual homosexual conference, the 4th National Homosexual Conference, was being held in Sydney. Of course, the police attack had to be resisted, and every time there was a court case, there would be another demonstration, there'd be more arrests. This went on for 6 months in the second half of 1978. So inevitably, when you've got 400 or 500 gay and lesbian activists gathered, they had at some point to march down to assert our right to march in the streets, at which point, of course, the police started arresting people again. In the midst of all this chaos, Graham Carberry, who's really the founder of the archives, persevered, and on the Sunday afternoon, a motion was passed by the kind of final plenary authorising the establishment of an Australian Gay Archive, as it was then called. This is important because the conference saw themselves as an expression of the movement. And it largely was. I mean, 400 or 500, 600 sometimes activists is really the movement gathering together for 3 or 4 days. The movement saw itself as what we would now think of as the community. So people, we saw ourselves as speaking for the broader community. So when the conference authorised the establishment of the Australian Gay Archives, it did created for the archive a certain kind of legitimacy and authority. Excuse me. In fact, still on our letterhead down the bottom, we have the tagline, an initiative of Fourth National Homosexual Conference, which I'm prepared to bet that 98% of people who see our letterhead have no idea what that's about. And it's really just about us speaking to our heritage, I think. The archives, people immediately started donating our stuff to us, though the movement emerges in Australia in 1969, 1970. The archives are established in 78, and people do, so we have a very good coverage for that first decade, although we didn't exist. The archives is based in Melbourne because that's where Graham Carberry happened to live. Generally speaking, Sydney is for fun, Melbourne is for seriousness, so it worked well, really, to have an archive in Melbourne. In terms of the structure of the organisation, it's volunteer run. We have no paid staff. We recently had a small grant to employ somebody for part-time for 6 months, which was really quite useful and important. Self-funded, we don't get any ongoing funding from government or anybody else. We get all our money from our membership, of which is about 350, and by donations, mostly from them. So when people renew their membership, they usually pay us some more as a donation. We're an incorporated association for legal protection, and so that we can, in fact, receive grants when they become available. But at the heart of the organisation is the membership, the AGM, which elects the annual general meeting, which elects the committee. Whether this model is still viable, which very much is based in the period in which it was formed, the collective structures, the legal registration for kind of pragmatic purposes rather than because we really believed it. We have elected office bearers at the AGM, but we really just sort of mix and match those jobs and share them out amongst ourselves. It's a very much kind of collective in some ways, in the way that the was common in the 1970s. Whether that model is still viable is something that Tim will be talking about as we reflect on our where we are at 40 years and where we're heading to. We're also entirely self-reliant, except for accommodation. Accommodation's always been the big deal for us, of course. We have 500 shelf metres of stuff now, beginning with a four-drawer filing cabinet in Graham Carberry's bedroom. We gradually expanded. We're expecting in the middle of next year to move into the new Victorian Pride Centre, which is being set up essentially by the state government as part of its sort of, friendliest LGBTI city in Australia strategy. But in the meantime, we were in a community centre. We were in Graham Carberry's basement. Graham Carberry physically dug a basement under his house because there was no room left in the bedroom. We're in the back of Cheryl's shop at one point. The Victorian AIDS Council stepped in the very late 90s to give us accommodation. It was in a basement in their building. Eventually some people moved out and they were able to move us upstairs, so we had natural light for the first time for a very long time. So the evolution of the space has been important, but we've always relied on ourselves, except to the extent that the Victorian AIDS Council has never charged us rent, which is an enormous boon to the organisation, because rent, as everyone will know, is the expensive thing. We talk about our mission, I guess, as collecting, preserving and celebrating Australia's very queer history. And celebrating is really about promoting the history, promoting the organisation, so that people are aware of our existence, can give us money, can give us materials, and we're very much seen as one of the key organisations of the community in Melbourne and indeed nationally. The celebrating stuff we do through exhibitions and history walks. We have an annual history conference, which again is held in different cities every year. We publish things like the Secret Histories of Queer Melbourne on the sort of bottom right there. We have a fourth-year thesis prize. We discovered that often in honours year, people are doing quite interesting work, but 2 years after they've done it, they're embarrassed and humiliated by how primitive it all seems. So we kind of get people to give it to us at the time, and we have a thesis prize, and that encourages people, just at the point where they're generally feeling good about their work, to hand it over to us. We have had people come back to us a couple of years later and say, "Can I take it back?" To which the answer obviously is no. Can I just edit it a bit? No. So, you know, we have to be hard sometimes to do the right thing. We have, of course, presence at festivals, both in Melbourne, Mardi Gras, Chill Out, which is, you know, a regional city in Melbourne. And, of course, we're open for researchers. But because we're a volunteer organisation, we can only make the place open when people are members of the committee and other senior people are available to open up. So we have regular Fridays. We used to have a regular Tuesday, we have a regular Monday night, Tuesday night, and volunteers and researchers can come in. And if we need to make other arrangements, we can from some time. All of this involves us working with both small community groups, of course, and individuals, but also with big institutions who are more and more interested in queer history and our ability to contribute to that. And in a previous session, as I said, we had a bit of a talk about the way in which big institutions, small institutions like us can interact. Again, this is something that Claire will be taking up in her contribution. The collection, as I say, is about 500 shelf metres, currently spread over three locations. Stuff, high-use material is available where we live, and then there's two off-site storages. I'm not going to go into the kind of stuff we collect. We collect really anything. We do live in fear that a drag queen will die and leave us their dress collection, because I'm not quite sure where we would put it. But other than that, we just take whatever people want to give us, on the principle that Joan Nessel was someone was talking about before. Take everything. You don't know what's going to be of value at some point. And then we have to sort of organise the process and so on with volunteers. Nick will be talking a bit about the evolution from the sort of the early collection was very much based on the movement and activism, but of course the growth of the community, first the commercial scene and then the much broader community, has led us or is leading us to shift our focus in terms of what we collect and who we work with. I want to talk a bit about the name. We will come back to the name question. Everybody's talking about this at the moment all over the world, really. One thing to say is we are the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives. We collect Australian material. Initially, there was an attempt to collect more broadly than that, but before my time, it became clear that was going to be too hard. And so while we have very good sets of things like Body Politics and Advocate and Gay News from the UK, we no longer actively collect international publications. We will backfill for gaps if they come. But essentially, we're much more interested in the Australian material, which is quite enough to be going on with. The other thing is the lesbian gay. We've known for a long time that this is an issue. We're now starting to deal with it. But one of the problems with the LGBTI thing is it excludes Australian experience. Indigenous people in Australia may well identify as LGBTI, but they may also identify as sister girls and brother boys, particularly in the north. These north of Australia. These are Indigenous identities that people live with and perform and do and are. And that stuff, so that when we came to rewrite our rules a couple of years ago because we had to, we were keen to include not just the LGBTI categories, but to try and identify the Australian material. We talk about human sexual orientation, behaviour and identity. We tried to allow for the ever-expanding, kind of what Carol was calling the alphabet soup. And, of course, the other kinds of aspects of queer life, the racial and ethnic, class, cultural, political, locational diversity. You know, where do people live? How do they live? Who are they other than through their sex and gender identities? And this has been really important. That's the kind of history of the organisation. It gets us to where we are. As I say, we've just had our 40th anniversary, which has been a chance to think about a whole bunch of issues. The Pride Centre is about to open, which provides us another opportunity to think about how we present ourselves publicly. And at this point we decided now would be a good time to think about the name change or the potential for name change for the organisation. And that's one of the things that Tim is going to touch on in his presentation.
Thanks, Graham. My name's Tim Jones. I'm a historian. I teach at La Trobe University in Melbourne. I've been a member of ALGA for about 14 years, maybe. I heard about it when I moved to Melbourne to study. I was very excited. I moved away from my family and moved to Melbourne and came out and discovered this amazing nerdy queer institution, which I thought was the coolest thing in the world. And then about 5 years ago, I was invited to think about joining the committee, and I've been on the committee for that time. And my time on the committee has been a time of significant change. I'm going to talk about some of those changes and think a bit more about the great things that are going on that are causing us to have to change, but also some of the tensions associated with that. And a lot of that is summed up in the name change consultation that we're going through. So I'm going to talk about the name change consultation, and then I'll talk more broadly about issues with professionalisation. So as Graham said, the archives were founded in 1978 as the Australian Gay Archives, and in 1991, recognising that the meaning of the term gay had changed and become more gender specific. I think in the 70s, gay was a much more inclusive term, but by the 90s, it was deemed appropriate to recognise gender difference and the changing meaning of the term. We became the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. But for as long as I've been involved with the archives, so at least for 15 years and perhaps longer than that, at every annual meeting there's been a discussion, we should change the name, it's exclusive of trans people, it's exclusive of different Indigenous identities, and so on. And we had that discussion every year, and then nothing was done. And the next year, someone brought it up at the annual meeting, and we had a discussion about it, and nothing was done. And this year, in tune with a lot of the other changes that we've been doing, we're actually doing something. It's a bit of a sensitive issue. The Archives is a community organisation. It's run by volunteers entirely. People have spent an extraordinary amount of their time, their effort, their care. People are attached to the archives. People's identities are bound up in it. So changing the name of something that is really precious to a community is a really difficult thing to approach. So the way that we are doing it is pretty gently to start with. There have been a lot of models of other organisations changing their name. Other archives have changed their name around the world. Most of the significant public LGBT organisations in Australia have been going through similar processes of looking at name change. So what the process that we decided to go through was sort of staging different kinds of consultations up until the annual meeting at the end of the year, where we'll put forward a proposal and see what happens. We decided to start out with interviews, is perhaps a little bit formal, but some conversations with key members, volunteers, people who have long histories with the archives, and key community groups, stakeholders, to see what their thoughts were, what their values, what their commitments were, what they thought the name should, and who they thought the name should represent, what was important about their understanding of the archives, and if they had any great ideas for different names, if they didn't want to change the name at all. We've got a live survey at the moment, which is open to anybody to respond to, and I suppose anybody here could have their 2 cents if they wanted to. After the surveys, we're going to have some focus groups to further workshop that and to find out what people feel about our current name, to discuss possible alternatives. And from all of that data, the conversations, interviews, survey, focus groups, will come up with some proposals or perhaps a single proposal to bring to the membership at the end of the year. I don't know if I need to say much more about that now, but I'd be very happy to talk about that more in discussion. But this is emblematic. I've illustrated this in a way that might not make much sense to most of you, but I think the most productive conversations that I have had about changing the name, obviously calling it Rainbow Archives makes me want to vomit for political reasons. And there are other options, naming it after particular people or having a long name or keeping the name. There aren't very many elegant ways to change the name. I like the idea that I think Claire and I came up in a conversation with was to call it after something Australian, distinctively Australian. And Claire informed me that platypuses have 10 sex chromosomes, which is going to put a... I think going to be competitive in the ever-expanding letters that are in the acronyms that might emerge in the future. So that might be a good symbol. It's distinctively Australian. We also like the quokka that Chris Hemsworth is seducing there, a distinctive Australian marsupial that begins with Q, quokka, queer. Anyway, there's lots of potential for queerness in Australian animals. That's why that's there. and also to kind of underlie the dryness about a presentation on accountability and professionalism. we are totes professional. There's been a need for us to become a bit more professional in the last few years. When I joined the committee about 5 years ago, the committee, I think, probably reflected the way it had been running for the previous 35 years, which was, as Graham indicated, very collective, reflecting the kind of the politics of the 1970s, where people would come together, we'd have great discussions, and very often not very much would get done. And the agenda of the next meeting would look very much like the agenda of the meeting before, and things would get done, the archives would tick over, but our major projects or significant things just kind of kept being discussed without very much happening. And a couple of like really good things have been happening that have forced us to become a little bit more productive. The state government, as Graham indicated, decided to invest in a Pride Centre, so that's significant LGBTI community groups could have a common home, like other similar centres elsewhere in the world, which is quite exciting. But moving into a more significant place in the public eye requires a degree of transparency and accountability that perhaps our previous committee structures wouldn't have stood up to the level of scrutiny that we may be under in the different context. Similarly, we've been receiving and have noticed that we are going to receive some very large requests of money. The generation of people that set up the archives are reaching the end of their lives, several people have been donating large parts of their estate or have given us notice that they're going to donate large parts of their estate to the archives, which opens up a whole series of possibilities of things that we might do. If we're going to be in receipt of hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of dollars in the near future, we really need to have a degree of accountability and transparency to honour those bequests and to face the rightful scrutiny that should lead to. And we've also been fortunate to be recipient of some more modest but significant government grants, which has enabled us to recently hire an office manager / consultant to help us through this process, to kind of streamline some of our processes, to balance the books a little bit, and to introduce procedures that will make the organisation stronger as it goes forward. So some of the things that they have looked like was at the end of last year, we had a consultant come in and develop a strategic plan for the archives with us. What are the goals that we really want to do, and what steps do we need to put in place to ensure that they go forward? Set up particular subcommittees, having a finance subcommittee, getting the required expertise to deal with the resources that we're going to have. Getting other kinds of expertise around legal governance and so on. And that's all been really great. We've got these opportunities to have a more visible public presence in the Pride Centre. We've got money coming in that's going to enable us to look after the collection in ways that weren't possible before, to perhaps in the not too distant future have a fractional permanent staff person to coordinate volunteers, to increase access, to increase visibility and so on. of the collection. That's all really great, but there are some tensions in this. The archives grew out of an activist movement and has had a collective community organisation, and moving into this strategic plan, key performance indicators, managerial kind of language sits a little bit at odds with with the spirit of the organisation as it has been. And I think as I've been reflecting on this, and initially I was a bit frustrated at some committee members' vociferous opposition to strategic plans and KPIs. But then I realised, I had some insight, which occasionally happens in my brain, that the form is the content. The way that we run, we're a community organisation, and the way that we act is our history. And an abrupt change in the way that we act is an abrupt change in our history. And I think I don't think there's any answers to that, but I think as we're going through this process of professionalisation, I think it's appropriate to think about ways in which we are managing and continuing and reinventing our history as an organisation as a keeper of, a keeper, maker and a preserver of our history. Thank you.
So I'm Claire O'Hanlon, and I like to say I'm a librarian by day and archivist by night. I do have a costume change, but I'm not really coordinated enough to pull that off. maybe for the discussion. So I'm going to be. I got involved. I'm one of the newest committee members. I got involved in 2016, near the end. Of that, and I'm now the secretary. And I'll be talking a little bit about, as a librarian by day, about how we have been collaborating across the GLAM sector and some possibilities for building on what we have been doing, and hopes and dreams. So I wanted to start with two quotes by people who are at this conference that have made me, sort of helped me realise how important it is to, for small community history organisations to collaborate with mainstream GLAM organisations, and some ideas for what we could do. So the first one is about an AIDS quilt that was, I guess, separated across, in a museum and in a community history organisation, and some challenges. Some challenges that definitely, particularly from the museum and the asymmetric relationships. I think it really called for. It had some examples of where shared ownership of objects. So that could be, and it really, it did illustrate. It called for us to combine our strengths. We each do have strengths, and there's a lot more we could do, and share our knowledge. The second, and I really also love the idea of the in this article about the Museum of Transology, the idea of maybe having a touring exhibition and combining that with collecting and archiving workshops to. to skill trans and queer communities to help them build their own museums and encourage more trans and queer people to enter the GLAM sector and help them find more of our histories in those mainstream collections and develop new collections. I also think that ELGA has become kind of a refuge for some LGBTIQ workers in the GLAM sector, definitely has for me, who have been struggling a bit in mainstream institutions, and it has increasingly, we've provided some training and some opportunities for GLAM, or like galleries, libraries, archives and museums students to get experience in cataloguing, conservation, curation, oral history transcription, preservation, and in a more safe, comfortable, welcoming and fun environment than they might otherwise encounter. So it's a good gateway to the sector. We've had student visits from library and information studies, and also quite a few undergrad students. And I know that the library and information studies group, they visit other community archives and libraries around the country, and the students really, really like visiting ELGA, and they really get a lot out of it. Some of them stay to volunteer. we've had an art curatorship master's internship, which was sort of in looking at photography, and then a cultural materials conservation master's research project. One of our really long-term volunteers did a research project trying to make conservation practices, or investigating how community archives can improve their conservation practices and make those practices more accessible to everyone, not just skilled professions. So we had some really good recommendations come out of that. And then, of course, we've had students come and use the collections for film production, and we have lots of volunteers, and increasingly from the GLAM sector, but not just. We also have co-hosted and supported a number of exhibitions. This is just quite a few of the, some recent and some not so recent. So mostly in libraries, but a few galleries in this. particularly, I really like the Unfinished Journey exhibition. It travelled around quite a number of different libraries, and I think that is one where we could build on that, and we could combine that with workshops. And a number of those libraries are already doing workshops in related, maybe not for LGBTIQ communities, but so they might be doing digital storytelling or family history research. So we could do a queer family history research workshop. It's good that the exhibition has travelled around quite a lot of different libraries, which is exciting. We've supported even more exhibitions by providing resources for them. As I work in a university library, research outputs are one of my favourite things to talk about. as Graham mentioned, we have the Honours Thesis Prize, and that is, we're probably one of the only places in Australia that has some of that really valuable data, even if it is emerging. there's no requirement really or a formal requirement for institutions to keep it. We have been research partners on a few projects. We use the knowledge for history walks, for publications. We've supported a few book launches. And perhaps we could do, maybe reading circles as well, providing access to historical periodicals, perhaps, and then I know a few groups who have been doing that sort of thing. But it would be good to go beyond books. That's what libraries are doing these days. So maybe with digital storytelling workshops, zine making workshops, we could have metadata parties to get people excited about cataloguing, maybe, just me. we've had some discussions about possible local history apps. And one thing that I'm quite excited about is, just as soon as I get back, pretty much, there's a reading making room that's going to take place aligned to an exhibition in Melbourne. And that's supported by an academic library, a local public library, and ELGA. So that'll encourage people to engage critically with research knowledge and make their own knowledge and critically and creatively. There's also been a few people who've wanted to donate research data to us, and some ethics committees university ethics committees query that. There's also a lot of people who don't think to donate to us, so it might be good to have a bit more of a process or become a bit more embedded in application processes. And I know a few libraries who are working in that space. In the past year alone, we have been invited to present to the Archivist Society, the Record and Information Management Professional Association, the Australian Library and Information Association, a group called New Cardigan, who try to bring professionals from all of those areas together. And we've had a discussion around collaborating in the GLAM sector at the Queer Legacies New Solidarities Conference. So people are really interested in working together, and they are definitely acknowledging that they can learn from us. It's not just them helping us. There's a really good guide that was produced by some guidelines for institutions, galleries and curators working with trans, non-binary and gender diverse artists. That can be A lot of those lessons can be applied across the GLAM sector. I highly recommend checking out the Kink Manifesto as well, and that started in Adelaide. and you can respond to it. They're definitely keen for people to respond. And then this explains the QOKKA a little bit. That was the Queer Organisation for Knowledge Keepers in Australia. Because I do think we need a support network or a solidarity network. I think because there are a lot of silos in the sector still, and they don't make collaboration easy. And of course, I am a librarian, so I had to sneak in a few readings, recommended readings. There are many more. And then you can contact me for further clarification if you have any queries on Twitter, or you can contact Elga on Twitter as well, or Facebook. I'm hoping to bring back Bibliographic Babbling, which I found in one of my favourite collections, which is from the Gay Librarians and Library Workers Group.
Do I just pop down the bottom? Oh, down here. Beautiful. Excellent. Okay, thank you so much for coming. My name's Nick Henderson. I've been on the committee for about 12 years. I am also a curator and archivist professionally. I work as a sound curator at the National Film and Sound Archive. So I'm going to talk a little bit about collection development with a bit of a reflection on the last 10 years versus the first 10 years. And so just for reference, if you go onto our Facebook page, this is our current banner, and it's a bit of a citation down the bottom from where that comes from. Okay. So when we were established, as Graham fleshed out in terms of the Fourth National Homosexual Conference, the proposal for our establishment, which I've put up there on the right, obviously it's too small to read, so I've just pulled out a little bit of a quote on the left there. Essentially, I guess the framing of our collection development at our inception was quite broad, as you can see, concerning gay people, their history, works, ideas, lifestyles, and interactions with heterosexual society. Despite the breadth of its framing, there was, I guess, a series of caveats in terms of how we were limiting that collection development.
You'll see down the end of that quote, and materials covering the same range of subjects and formats from other countries, especially the UK and Canada, but only the most relevant books and periodicals from the USA. So even at that early stage, I guess there was an awareness that there was just a volume of material being produced in the US, and that was we weren't able to accommodate that. But interestingly, there's no reference to our nearest geographical neighbours, so nothing to New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia or the Pacific. So as Graham mentioned, the nascent collection came from its founders, in particular key founder and driver Graham Carberry, and at its inception it filled a four-drawer filing cabinet. Other founding volunteers contributed material from their own collections, building early series of 1970s periodicals, ephemera, legislation and newspaper clippings, essentially the printed record of the movement at the time. Periodicals were scanned for organisational contacts and letters were sent out to existing and newly formed groups requesting missing publications and being added for the archives to be added to the mailing lists. The growing networks that were established by the archives, both through those contacts and also through the National Homosexual Conferences, which continued into the mid-80s, gradually, I guess, began accumulating material almost straight away. So from our inception, those networks spread out across Australia, but there are also limitations associated with those networks. So with a relatively low public profile locally, what was received reflected those networks from its early volunteers and supporters. The limitations were particularly around geographical reach. It's almost 4,000 kilometres by road between Perth in the west and Sydney in the east, and over 3,700 kilometres from Melbourne to Darwin by road. And many community groups and individuals, understandably, wanted their records close to hand. So aside from our periodicals collections, our holdings were largely focused on the southeast of the continent in those other areas around archival unpublished materials. Limitations also existed around lesbian feminist activism, largely due to the rise of a series of state-based women's liberation and lesbian feminist archives across Australia. Our holdings of early transsexual and bisexual activism reflected their limited development during this period, and I'm still talking about that first 10 years. Similarly with Aboriginal multicultural groups. As the decade progressed, however, the diversity of our collection material and formats increased, somewhat fulfilling the diversity, or aspirational diversity reflected in our original proposal. So from those first 10 years, I'll talk a little bit more about what's changed. So not surprisingly, the period from 1978 to the end of the 80s compared to the last 10 years is quite a bit. Perhaps most notably, the communities we aim to represent are now more expansively and specifically framed in Australia, which is most commonly referred to in Australia as LGBTI, which is also seen to be inclusive of brother boys and sister girls, as has been previously discussed. So I guess in terms of the nature of our collecting process, perhaps the most notable thing has been how we contact individuals and organisations. So instead of being put onto mailing lists, I'm just as likely to be contacting people by email, by LinkedIn, Facebook or Instagram. And the subject of those inquiries increasingly relates to the acquisition of born digital material rather than analogue formats. So the ability to directly connect with individuals via social media, many of whom have not been part of formal community organisations and others, but have been, living particularly individual diverse lives, often away from those organisations, has been a boon for collecting personal papers in particular. It's also been a boon for cataloguing and enhancing descriptive metadata around orphaned collection materials. So often we'll receive large collections where we don't know a lot of information about individuals or places, venues or spaces. The development of our own Facebook page and group, as well as a series of metropolitan focused LGBTI history groups, has also been significant in this increase. On screen, this is just a few examples of some of our Facebook posts. For example, on the left, you can see some of our volunteers and researchers. We do like to highlight the kind of work that goes on in the archives, both volunteer and research, recent acquisitions, and some volunteer work and focus in terms of conservation. So the Lost Gay Groups in Australia. Australia has a whole series of, as I mentioned, these Facebook groups. The first was set up in Sydney in 2012. And I guess very quickly it expanded to over 5,000 people. It's now 6,650 members who've shared well in excess of 20,000 personal photos. So the archive's increasing profile, direct connections with new donors, and focused collection development projects have ensured that our acquisitions have increased by about 100% in the last 10 years. So we currently receive about 120 collections each year, and that can range from small numbers of items to incredibly large and diverse collections. So as with many archival institutions, both public and private, the archives has had to cope with both analogue and digital deluges. As activists from the 1970s and 80s retire and look to downsize, we've been faced with offers of collections of personal papers of very large volume. Similarly, with the advent of digital photography and the shift into digital organisational management, we've also been faced with collections encompassing tens of thousands of digital files. In both cases, we've had to modify the extent of processing required to manage this material. And our collection development has also shifted in response to an increasing focus on in-house exhibitions, loaning collection material for external exhibitions, and our planned museum exhibition space in the Victorian Pride Centre. So that's led to an increasing focus on objects, artworks, and other material. So I wanted to kind of finish off by talking about proactive collection development. So, as has been, noted, there's various limitations and omissions in terms of the archival record, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Proactive collection development projects that have been undertaken have had the aim of filling those collections gaps. So particular projects, and particular focus areas have been around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, leather and fetish community, sports, sex workers, and transgender community. So the archives have always collected across all of these areas, but the intent behind the proactive collection development projects have been to really enhance the specific, the depth and breadth in these areas. So how have we approached that? Each has been quite different, but there's been, some themes amongst those. So developing long-term relationships with key community leaders, supporting existing community projects and groups with collection digitisation and support, so not requiring, in a sense, not putting that obligation on communities who may not have had the same level of access and support behind them. Promoting our holdings and research widely into both mainstream LGBTI and sub-community groups, and having a regular presence at community events through information stalls, loans to exhibitions, and promoting these online. So some, in the case just of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, some of these projects have included the Black Mardi Gras project. So Mardi Gras is one of the most, visible and public events in Australia. The history of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander involvement in that event has been a project run by a guy in Sydney who's had long connections with a lot of community organisations. So it's just a bit of an example up on the top left. From an online project, and it's a timeline which has a lot of content material. There's also a Facebook group which has been part of the cataloguing and enhancement process for that. Other material includes the Kurigrah exhibition, for which we loan material down the bottom left. Down in the middle lower section is some exhibitions that Ange Bailey, our president, has curated and provided focus on. This is material by Peter Waples Crow. On the bottom right, you'll see some new postcards, and obviously you'll see them on your chairs. Please, there's a few spares, so please take the full set. And on the left-hand side here of those two, you'll see this Malcolm Cole. He was an Aboriginal and South Sea Islander, and a dancer, performer, community activist, HIV/AIDS activist. And here, this is the first Aboriginal float in Mardi Gras, and he's, he's dressed as Captain Cook. So it's, it was a prominent float in that in that year's Mardi Gras, and you can find out much more information if you go onto the Black Mardi Gras website. We also have been involved in different Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander HIV history projects, and there's the HIV AIDS special issue and an online gallery as part of that. And Yurrumboy on the right, this was an Indigenous arts festival in Melbourne and providing material as part of exhibitions in that context. So I just wanted to wrap that up by saying, I guess, where to from here? There is, of course, always a lot more to do around collection development. It never ends. Archives don't generally get smaller, they only increase. So all of our focus areas are areas that we still need to do a lot more work on. And there are many others besides, and perhaps most notably around multicultural communities. I guess the other part of that is organisationally. So as you can see, our committee has, is fairly white and doesn't actually reflect, I guess, the diversity which is in our broader volunteer base. So getting very diverse volunteers involved in more organisational and decision-making processes is something which I think is one of the next steps to really look at different ways that we can focus and diversify our approach. So thank you.
I have a question about acquisitions. Sure. So I was wondering if you've seen any competition with, say, larger institutions, universities, archives that might be interested in this sort of material now that weren't in the past. Do you have like a competition for acquiring things, or do they defer to you? Say, oh, it should go to the gay archives.
Sure. To an extent, yes. There's been different projects by institutional libraries in particular. The archives is physically located in one city, and Australia is very large. We don't aim to collect everything, and certainly the way that we approach collection development, while it is Australia-wide, we have deference to different cities for how they want to, approach that, and individuals. We certainly can provide different approaches to material. One of the things I find quite interesting currently with institutions is because of reduced staffing numbers, there's often the expectation that the donors process material themselves. The level of processing, particularly of archival material, that gets undertaken now is not of the same level that was undertaken with higher staff numbers and smaller material coming in. So one of the things, I guess, that we can do in that context is provide that level of processing. So, for example, one collection which was going to be offered to the University of Sydney Library, I guess in talking to the donor, they agreed to donate it to us because we were going to, basically offering to do full processing rather than that happening. I guess a lot of institutions are now actively acquiring material, and certainly, that puts us into some competition. One of the strengths that we have that we, I guess, suggest in others is that material can sit within a much larger network of material. Material can sit as often a standalone item or collection within larger institutions that have broader focus, mainstream libraries, but within the archives, it fits within a much broader research context. So, I don't know if that.
Any other
can I say something? Oh, that's really loud. I'm an Australian, but I live here in Berlin, so it's really great to hear all about what you've been doing. And I'm originally from Adelaide, but I also lived in Melbourne, so I'm interested in, it was sort of touched on by some of the different speakers, how do you see in the future the archive potentially connecting to the challenge of Australia, but around Australia? Because it's something that I would have loved to see in an Adelaide institution, maybe in a touring way, or is there a plan to work more on digitising material, which I know is a massive labour process, but it's somewhere like Australia is also maybe really exciting because it opens it up to a broader audience. So yeah, how do you, this is, yeah, you just mentioned this, but how can, what do you see as ways of sharing the archive around Australia in the future?
I might do just an initial response. Yes, we are in the process of doing a digitisation project. At the moment, it's particularly focused on periodicals. As many people would have seen the Gale stall over here, we are currently, in the process of contributing to that at the start of a digitisation project looking at 122 titles with a very broad Australian focus, about 250,000 pages. So that's certainly one project in that context. We provide a lot of research support over and above general reference support to people who can't come to Melbourne physically. We've also done projects in other states. So, for example, in Adelaide, one exhibition, we've done contributed material to a couple of projects there, but we did an exhibition in conjunction with the State Library of South Australia. There's been other kind of projects in that context, as well as taking the history conference to Adelaide, we've done projects up in Darwin. It's always a challenge to try and support other communities and lend material and digitise material, make it more accessible. So we're also doing, Richard down front, who's also from the Archives Committee, was talking about our online catalogue project, so hopefully providing a lot more.
Tomorrow morning, first thing. I also think that, yeah, there is definitely a role. There is quite a lot of, not a lot, but there are a few groups in New South Wales in particular who are also community history groups. They collect their own, and they quite like, I know some of them like keeping that material local so that they can, it's more easily accessible to them. There's opportunities to collaborate with them as well and support them. Help set up little local ranches. Or we do have a representative from Queensland on our committee. That's probably our newest committee. I think there's lots we could, collaborate more with the larger institutions as well.
Thing about the competition that there might be for collections. There's nothing like the kind of, certainly the US, maybe North American market for this stuff. It would be, I can only think of one time we've actually bought something at auction, and then we went back to the person who was selling and said, do you want to donate the money we just gave you? And he did. We have a policy of trying to resist as much as we can the commercialisation of this history. Because at some point it would become, particularly internationally, it would be very difficult for us to compete. So there's a kind of passive resistance going on to that, which minimises the amount of commercial competition. And libraries also, they will buy important collections, but they don't normally, just as a matter of course.
Yeah, thank you all. I have a question about the decision-making process in your institution. Tim, you mentioned that a little bit when it came to the naming of the institution. I was wondering whether the same is the case for collection development, for example, or are these decisions made by the committee? Are you discussing this with the members? So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. So the committee, that the governance structure of the archives, it's a sort of a managing committee. The committee is the group that makes the day-to-day decisions, that kind of proposes and runs policy, and is guided by the annual meetings, and very sensitive to the concerns of the meetings, and becoming increasingly responsive to that, has become better at actually doing things and not just talking about them. We don't have a board, and we have these discussions about what actually our role is at different times, but we essentially function as a managing committee that does the work of formulating policy, identifying areas where we need to do work more proactively, and any sort of big changes get put to the membership. Graham, do you want to add anything to that?
I might just a little, I guess in the sense of collection development, we have a mission statement, we have a collection development policy. I guess in terms of the detailed decisions of what gets accepted and what doesn't, broadly we had an agreement at our committee that smaller collections and straightforward processes that fall within our collection development policy, I manage those, and those collections that are larger, more complex, have more preservation requirements, get brought to committee for decision. So I guess part of the process for us in looking at complex acquisitions, particularly where there's preservation concerns, audiovisual materials, complex items that might be, you know, could be mould affected or damaged, or you know, costumes is a good example. You know, looking at something where often a lot of performance costumes are poorly made, fall apart, they're made with hot glue. It's not straightforward for an organisation to look at large, that doesn't have the space to look at very large complex acquisitions. So we need to look at how we manage that. So yeah, we kind of split that process between the two.
Could you maybe expand a bit on the move to the Victoria Pride Centre and what that looks like? I mean, we haven't seen it, but yeah, and how the committee feels about it.
So it started with, we were housed for free at the Victorian AIDS Council building in South Yarra in Melbourne. They suddenly realised the value of the land that they had their, you know, tacky little former factory on, and it went from being worth, I don't know, $500,000 to literally 13 million over the course of their 20 or 30 years. So they decided to sell. In the course of deciding that, they thought they would have a kind of community hub so that not just the archives would be there, but lots of organisations would be invited to be in their new building. That got quite a good response and the discussion started. And then the Victorian State Government, which is a Labor government, decided this was a wizard idea and they were going to get involved. To the tune of $10 million up front, which made quite a difference in two ways. One is it was a lot of money. The AIDS Council were going to put in $10 million or so, Victorian government $10 million, that was pretty much cover it. But it also, of course, creates accountability issues, so it slowed the process tremendously. The AIDS Council, for reasons that they've never very much made public, decided they weren't going to go with the Pride Centre in the end. So now it's the Victorian Government, with an independent board that they've established and appointed. They're very keen. Everybody's always been keen to have us. We are a beloved institution, and we're big and we're stable, and we're the kind of thing you want, kind of anchoring this. The other big ones are the community gay radio station. What have I missed? The other big
Midsummer.
Sorry? Midsummer?
Minus 18, which is a youth social support organisation. It's very large. Gay counselling service, which is a telephone counselling service and online, which is similarly large.
Film festival. Yes, so the point of it is that you can have these big institutions like us that need a lot of space, and then you have things that have a much more flexible year. You know, the film festival gets very busy for part of the year and then tails off. Some people just need a meeting room. So it's a wonderful kind of project and it's looking very good. They're furiously raising the money that the VAC didn't chip in. There were hopes that the federal government, in fact the Labor Party said they would, and then they failed to win the election. Treachery, betrayal. So it's definitely going ahead. In fact, they're starting building, you know, the kind of laying of the pipes or something this week. And we expect to be in second half of next year. I should say again, the idea that we don't have to pay for rent has prevailed. We'll pay a share of the operating expenses, but nothing like the real or even the minimal rent costs. Over here.
Can you say something about the kind of exhibition space and storage space that will become available?
I can talk a little bit about that. So in the sense, it's a purpose design space for us. So it, one of the great things is that we've been involved with the architects as part of the design. And so that's meant that part of the process has been that we're, like, for example, we'll be having a separate air condition system from the main part of the building. You know, there's UV film. The floor is reinforced. They even increased the height of the building, which changed the various planning requirements for the spot. It's quite large. It's 5 or 6 stories. There's over 60 community organisations that will be in the building. Our permanent exhibition museum space will also be adjacent to our reading room and collection storage. We'll have about 0.5 kilometre or perhaps a bit more on site in within the reading room space, as well as processing volunteer space, office space, and a library type space. There's also scope for temporary exhibitions within the building, as well as broader temporary exhibitions that the other community organisations can use and develop. So yeah, it'll be quite diverse in that sense of having multiple spaces that can be used for exhibition and for us in terms of collection storage.
I think what is interesting too is that we have become the only voice in that space of the Pride Centre in terms of considering exhibitions. So when we've met with the architects, it's very much like there's a big sort of vast sort of space in the middle of the building which goes up the 6th floor, an atrium. And we sort of said, well, what about you put a hook up the top? So in case there's ever any sort of performances or any sort of displays or public art that might be able to incorporate. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, we can put a hook up there. So we've tried to really engage with them to sort of work out better ways to exhibit within the space.
One of the other interesting things about thinking about moving into the Pride Centre is how it's going to change the organisation. We've been an organisation that's been in people's back rooms, garages, basements, you know, with small amounts of working space and all of that. And the prospect of moving into a purpose-built building where they put 30 centimetres of extra concrete to hold our compactus, that's going to have, like, that's going to be very visible and very accessible, creates a lot of potentiality for different kinds of activities to be done in our space, for our collection to be used in different ways. But then also challenges around accountability that I talked about, but also challenges about staffing, managing the space, which I think is potentially really exciting, the thinking about the way in which our history and our collection can be used to kind of create a new kind of community space. Part of the challenge of this, the tensions and discomfort perhaps with professionalisation is perhaps also offset with perhaps we could, we've talked about having, like, you know, zine making groups or like reading groups for like older queer people, or, you know, all the different kinds of ways that this new space could be used to support the community and make history kind of more of a living and breathing thing for more people.
The other thing that's changed is that the digitisation that Gail are doing, using the periodicals has up to now been the kind of most use that we get. That's what people come in to go through. If it's now digitally available in state libraries, university libraries and so on, I imagine that will cut that usage. In order to be present in the centre, we have to be visible, we have to be showing we're using it. You know, it's a gift to us in lots of ways. So it really, it's yet another thing that will change the way we work and the way we think about what we're doing and what we're there for. So all the rest of the collection is still only physically, you know, the posters and the photos and so on are mostly physical. You would have to come in. But the biggest single usage to date will change, and that's part of this broader change. It's yet another piece in the moving pieces.
So do you have charitable status?
Sorry?
Do you have charitable status? Can you
give, yes, we do. Yeah.
For material that's donated?
Well, we don't have. I know the Canadian organisation will give people a tax credit.
That's right.
That you estimate the value of the donation, you know, kind of, and then you give them a certificate to say that they can claim that against the tax. We have this in Australian law, but we've never used it. We could find out how to, but we've just never had to. Again, it's this kind of non-commercial basis of the whole thing, really.
In the Australian context, you have to register, and then it has to be valued by two separate valuers. If there's a more than 10% difference, you have to get a third valuation. You have to pay for that valuation as the institution. There's a whole series. So it does become a bit more complex.
But also Australian, the question earlier about competition for collections, Australian universities don't have the kinds of bequests and finances to pay large amounts of money for archival collections. So in our context, the collections don't have the same monetary value as they might be in other countries.
In Australia, a lot of the legislation that guides that sort of thing varies from state to state, so that complicates the situation, the incorporation of associations. It makes it very difficult to run a national organisation at all. But my question, Graham, following on what you said about a lot of your membership, your foundation membership, now reaching the end of their lives, how are you building the membership and how are you managing the expectations of membership as you move into the new world of what you are to become?
I'm not sure we know anything, and maybe other people do, where our new members come from, but it increases every year. And you always get we have annual membership. We remind people you lose a certain proportion, but we always end up with more. I would guess the social media and our visibility at community events, Pride festivals and fair days and things, in terms of getting more members, they don't get anything. On the other hand, we only charge them $20. So it's really an act of support on their part, and so there aren't high expectations amongst the members. They do it because they think we're worthwhile. Most of the members pay their $20 and tap something onto the top as a donation. So it's a kind of a goodwill relationship. In terms of the second half of your question, I mean, keeping them low has been our strategy up to this point, but that will change as we become, you know, we're embedded in this big, gorgeous new building. We're very visible. What will people want from us? I'm not sure we know. I'm not sure we can know until it starts to happen.
But Graham, one of the points in our strategic plan was...
I must read the strategic plan.
To communicate what our goals and purposes are, because as we've gotten more profile recently, and our profile has gone through the roof, our membership has gone through the roof, actually. So we haven't had trouble getting members, but their expectations has been an issue. People don't realise that we're a community organisation run by volunteers outside of work time, and don't have the resources to do, you know, to do what they think. I think lots of people think we're a professional organisation with paid staff that can do like all kinds of things. So actually communicating what we do, how we run, is a key part of the way that we go forward.
Although I think what I've found in terms of providing research or reference support, the highest expectation is usually media companies. So with when it comes around to major events, and most recently with Stonewall, there's been a lot of requests for material, CBC, NBC in America, different book publishers doing different things, wanting material, expecting immediate turnaround times, plus all the requirements for releases and new vendors and all of this. And we have fairly low, amounts that we charge for anything. It's just, you know, it's minimal compared to what a photo library is. But the expectations are that we're professional in terms of the response times, in terms of all these requirements, and that can be quite tricky. In terms of the membership, I think it has largely been probably social media. We now have, heading on 9,000 people who like our page, pushing out content, gets it in people's faces, but it certainly hasn't, we definitely don't have 9,000 members. That would be rather nice, but, you know, it does get that information out there to an extent, but doesn't always keep people in that frame. And I guess one of the challenges for us is looking at ways that we can build up or reinforce members to stay, and also geographically expand that, because our membership is also broadly in the southeast, from Brisbane down to Adelaide.
Before I forget, ranked choice voting. I'm a member of a Society of American Archivists, and we changed our name to something. Anyway, and the way they had set up the election was they picked three, like rainbow and something else and something else, and then the one they wanted to win. And so that one. So ranked choice voting might be a way to go. So at least you can always campaign for your second choice. And anyway, what are you going to do with your digital materials after the Gale contract expires?
We have access like that.
Are you going to make it wider? Right now you would have to pay to access it, but once your contract ends...
We don't have to pay.
But everybody else could get it for free after the contract ends, right?
I think that's right.
So how are you going to make that available?
I guess there's various issues in that context. Obviously, the relationship that we have, with Gale is something that we, look at in the next stage after the contract comes to its conclusion. At present, we don't have capability to be able to set up a system that can deal with the volume of metadata and the OCR system search functionality. We're moving into a situation where we'll have more, but it is a very complex search functionality from our perspective as a community organisation. Whether or not we would have the capacity to do that moving forwards, in an ideal sense, yes, we would love to be able to provide that in-house. We don't have that capability. Hopefully we can move forward, and Richard can probably talk more to that. But I think there are a lot of ways that we need to look at how we can provide access to material, and that's well beyond the periodicals. That is one component of our collection, but there is a lot more material, obviously, and a lot more complex material in different ways, from objects to banners, to textiles, to T-shirts, to leather jackets, to dildo molds. We have a lot of different types of material. So in terms of the context of stuff, it is, all of those things need to be looked at rather than, a particular approach around textual material.
In terms of the Gale project that we're working on, one of the advantages of working with Gale is that to disseminate the information that Gale is going to digitise, most of that's accessed by academic researchers, which means that those people have access to university libraries and things like that. That means that ALGA doesn't have to provide any infrastructure to enable those particular people to access our collection. That actually takes a weight off our organisation to have to provide that sort of infrastructure in the future. And that'll be one of the things that I think we'll be considering at the end of the initial contract with Gale. It may be expedient simply to continue with the relationship.
I guess the other thing is...
Early days.
Increasingly, our focus in terms of collection development and also collection access is archival material. It's unpublished material. And for particularly complex collections, a lot of the research material and research work that is going on now, it will change the nature of research being text searchable, and that's one of the fundamental benefits, as well as the diversity and being able to search lesser-known publications. One of the areas, I guess, in terms of where there is the richness of material is the depth and complexity of archival material. And that's really where, I guess, the focus of collection processing and development needs to be able to uncover that. Bibliographic processing is relatively straightforward, as you know. So the process of doing archival management is a bit different. So.
Okay, we need to wrap it up. A couple of things. Richard is talking about our cataloguing project, which is a major project we've been doing for some time now. And you're on a panel? Done. I may have missed Ange's panel. So that's us done. Thank you very much for coming along. And if you've got questions and stuff, feel free to stop us anytime in the next couple of days.